This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. The lockdowns in response to COVID-19 have upended no part of our lives more than education. Virtually no K-12 schools are open for business with full-time in-person instruction anywhere in the country. The result is something approaching pandemonium for students, parents, and educators alike, all of whom are scrambling to make sense of a system that no longer seems capable of doing what it's supposed to do. Even taxpayers are starting to get pissed. The one constant? Critiques of school choice by wealthy, well-connected liberals and progressives, such as Samantha Bee, the host of Full Frontal on TBS. In a recent segment called How the School Choice Debate is Failing Our Public Schools, Bee took a dark view of alternatives to traditional public schools, warning that private and charter schools can be especially problematic because some states have virtually no oversight over them. As a matter of fact, Bee is wrong, especially about charter schools, which are always overseen by either local or state education officials. But her anxiety and that of other defenders of the status quo is understandable. The lockdowns and forced shift to mostly virtual learning are driving massive interest in alternatives to the residential assignment schools most Americans have attended for decades. Angry pushback from teachers' unions who don't want to go back to the classroom, and the desultory quality of learning via Zoom is activating parents in a way that white papers on school reform never did. For today's podcast, I spoke with Corey DeAngelis, the director of school choice for Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast. We talked about why COVID-19 will almost certainly spur long-lasting interest in school choice, and also about the success of the new collection he co-edited with Neil McCluskey of the Cato Institute, a book called School Choice Myths, Setting the Record Straight on Education Reform. In a wide-ranging conversation, we also discussed Joe Biden's antagonism towards school choice, especially charters, and whether Donald Trump's historic and warm embrace of school choice is actually a mixed blessing for reformers. It's a good show. Here is the Reason interview with Corey DeAngelis. Corey DeAngelis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, you've got a brand new collection out, School Choice Myths. It's an anthology of essays about school choice that you and Neil McCluskey of the Cato Institute co-edited. What's the elevator pitch of school choice myths?
Well, there's tons of myths that float around in the school choice debate and have been floating around in the school choice debate for a very long time. There's probably 100, so we had to limit the book to just 12 of them, but we get some of the biggest authors on school choice to take on myths such as school choice defunds public schools, school choice leaves children behind in the public schools, school choice leads to inequities, and we also squash myths such as school choice has racist origins, which you can learn more about in our in my recent Soho Forum debate with Professor John Hale.
Sure.
But we use a lot of data to combat these claims that are floating around the concept of school choice. And we use moral arguments to take on these claims as well. But
you know, one of the essays, I think it's the last essay in the collection, is by Virginia Walden Ford, who is, you know, one of the great pioneers of school choice, really created the DC Opportunity Scholarship Program, was the subject of Miss Virginia, a very good movie that came out within the past year. She debunks the idea that poor parents will make bad choices. What is her basic argument on that?
Yeah, well, disadvantaged families, all families in general, have more information and incentives to get these decisions right than bureaucrats sitting in offices thousands or hundreds of miles away. And this is one of the biggest arguments that is against school choice, is people think that families, primarily disadvantaged families, are going to make bad decisions about where they're going to send their children. And they try to say that, you know, they use different language about it, where they'll say that there's information asymmetries in the market for education,
sure,
or, you know, they just might not have the information necessary to make good choices. But disadvantaged families make all sorts of choices when it comes to their children all the time. A lot, and in a lot of other industries that have difficult decisions to make as well. Nutrition's a hard decision to make, but you know, opponents of, or these same people who oppose school choice don't say that families shouldn't be able to use food stamps to shop at different, to choose different grocery stores.
Although, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think what it, you know, it, it kind of fulfills the paternalism in a lot of social welfare kind of paternalism, right? Of because people do say with, you know, with SNAP benefits, with food stamps, you can't spend it on, you know, this product, but you can buy this. So in a weird way, it's consistent. But I know Virginia Walden Ford shows that, you know, when you look at the data, low-income parents who send their kids to charter schools or schools of choice are genuinely very happy with what they, you know, what they end up with.
Yeah, they're very satisfied. If you look at a review of the evidence by Evan Rinesmith, published in the Journal of School Choice in 2017, overwhelmingly the evidence on private school choice programs shows that when families get a choice, they're very satisfied with these, with the schools that they chose. And even when you look at things like standardized test scores, the evidence generally suggests that families pick schools that lead to higher test scores. That's not always the case, but it, particularly when you look at things like satisfaction and safety, the evidence is much more favorable towards choice. And I think that's because families make decisions about particular schools based on a whole different, a whole wide array of metrics of quality. Some of that could be measured in a standardized test score, but children are much more than standardized test scores. They're, you know, they care about the safety of their children, the character skill formation of their children, and a whole bunch of other outcomes.
It is, you know, it's also amazing. And I say this as somebody who is overeducated. My ex-wife, we have two children together, also we are as educated as you can be, as are you in this society. And we did not, you know, merely because we had PhDs in literature and, you know, English of all things. So, you know, we really didn't know necessarily know how to meet our kids' needs, you know, when you're talking about K through 12 education. So it's this, you know, there is that real soft bigotry of low expectations on, you know, that, oh, well, smart people, successful people will know a good school when they see it. And poor people who have a lot more really riding on where their kid goes to school, you know, will be completely snookered by, you know, the equivalent of a used car salesman when it comes to picking a kid, a school for their kids.
Yeah, and I would just argue that, you know, these families, even low-income families, have better information and better incentives to get these decisions right. Some families might make incorrect decisions, or they may make a mistake, but we can't forget that the public schools sometimes make bad decisions for families as well. And I would say the rate of error is likely to be higher in the public schools when it comes to making decisions for other people's children than when families are able to be empowered to make their own decisions for their own families' educational environments.
Talk about your particular, you have a chapter in the school choice, Myths of School Choice book. What is your chapter about?
Yeah, the myth is that children aren't widgets, so education mustn't be left to the market.
Right.
The first statement, no one can argue with that, but the second part is a non sequitur. And I would respond that it's true that children aren't widgets, but that's why we shouldn't have a one size fits all uniform public school system that we force everybody into. Instead, because children aren't widgets, we should allow these families to sort their children to the institutions that work best. The public school could be best, the best match for a particular student, and you should still have that choice as a family. But if for whatever reason that doesn't work out for your family, you should be able to choose a private charter homeschool or micro school option as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, you know, particularly in an age of artisanal everything, where, you know, when back in the days, I guess, right, the before times, when you could actually walk into a Starbucks, you could tailor your drink to whatever you felt like having that day. And, you know, there are an almost infinite number of combinations, and that widely spread throughout all of our consumer experiences these days and our reading experiences and what we watch on TV and all of this kind of stuff. And it's bizarre then that, you know, people are using this old argument really from the 60s and maybe 70s or the early days of school choice, saying, oh, well, you know what, like, you know, the free market is only good at producing one kind of unit of anything at cheap costs, as opposed to actually what markets have been demonstrated to do over the past 20 or 30 years is actually give everybody what they want, you know, at lower prices with more individualization.
Yeah, and we see that choice is the norm when it comes to higher education and pre-K as well. Even when we're using taxpayer-funded initiatives like Pell Grants and the GI Bill, the money goes to the student, and students can pick a public or private university of their choosing. Right. They don't have to use that money at their nearest government-run community college, for example. And with pre-K, the money with these programs, even if they're taxpayer-funded, goes to the families, and the families have a choice in the matter. They can pick public or private pre-K programs. And what's weird to me is a lot of the people who support these taxpayer-funded initiatives when it comes to pre-K and higher education, some for some reason oppose it, the money following the child, when it comes to K through 12 education in the between years. And the only reason that I could kind of conjure up as to why this might be is because the power dynamic is different in K through 12, and that the norm in pre-K and higher ed is that people can already take their money to the institution that works best for them. But when it comes to K through 12, the funding that currently exists in that system goes to institutions regardless of that choice. So you have an entrenched special interest that profits from the current funding system. So relative to the status quo, K through 12 vouchers are an increase in individual liberty and an increase and a decrease in monopoly power for that entrenched institution. You don't have that same kind of power dynamic when it comes to pre-K and higher education.
Yeah. That makes it that much more harder to reform. We're going to talk a little bit about reform ideas, kind of reform dynamics, because the ideas, I think, were out there. You've been articulating them. Certainly, School Choice Myths, the book, discusses a lot of them, as well as your work and your Twitter feed, which is a phenomenal read. But for now, can we talk specifically, and this is less about kind of political dynamics and more about just kind of pragmatics. How are the COVID lockdowns changing the delivery of K through 12 education? Because this is I don't want to say it's a natural experiment, because it's an unnatural experiment. It proceeds from a series of bad policy choices, in my opinion, that schools have been locked down. But, you know, starting in the spring, but extending into the fall for many, many school districts around the country, kids are not going to school either at all or only, you know, one or two days a week. But how are the lockdowns changing the delivery of education? And how do you think that's going to affect arguments about school choice or individual student funding, backpack funding, in the near term and in the longer term?
Yeah, I think there are two effects here. One is that people are re-envisioning the factory model of schooling itself, because a lot of people are getting a taste of homeschooling. And while some people don't like what they're experiencing with homeschooling, they weren't homeschooling anyway. So at least they got to figure that out. But a large portion of families are saying that they like homeschooling now. If you look at the latest data from EdChoice, every month that they've surveyed families from April, May, June, July, and I believe August as well, they found that families are much more likely, about twice as likely, to say that they now have a more favorable view of homeschooling as opposed to saying that they now have a less favorable
view. That does not include any of the people on Reason Magazine staff who have kids in K through 12. Without naming names, although they're happy to volunteer that information themselves, it seems that, you know, if you are I'm genuinely surprised to hear that, because if you're in a two-income household and you have a couple of kids, and you're all at home because nobody's going to the workplace anymore, everybody seems to be complaining, in my experience, about the quality of the instruction that's coming through Zoom classes or through, the internet, and then also just the claustrophobia of everybody being in this kind of pre-Marxist dream world of, where the household, everybody's all together all the time.
Yeah, and that's another good point that we need to be clear when we're talking about remote learning and homeschooling. Is it true homeschooling? Is it virtual charter schooling? Or is it a public schooling environment at home where the public schools are just trying to cobble things together? Ian Kingsbury just released a study through EdChoice where he surveyed families with children in virtual charter schools versus traditional schools that were doing remote learning. And he found overwhelmingly that the families with children in virtual charter schools were much more satisfied with the remote instruction than the families with children in the traditional schools doing remote instruction. So I think it could be competitive pressures that lead to this difference, that the virtual charters know that they need to cater to the needs of their customers if they want to keep their business. But it could also just be a timing thing and that adaptation thing where the virtual charter schools had been doing this for decades already. And so they were virtually unaffected by the pandemic and the school lockdowns because they continued with business as usual for the most part, whereas the traditional schools had to cobble something together really quickly. Maybe they had to face a lot of regulations in the traditional sector that kind of tied their hands behind their backs. And maybe it was just a last minute thing where they figured out that they didn't have the infrastructure in place to serve a lot of students in this short amount of time.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a real learning curve. I mean, I think everybody who is working more from home than not and using things like Zoom or Skype or you know, just regular teleconferences, there's a real learning curve to putting stuff online. I have a number of friends who are college professors who are, now into their second semester of remote learning, and they will confess they don't know what they're doing. They don't know how best to transfer that. And I guess if you're talking about a classroom with 25 or 40 kids, where do you see it? Are there school districts that you are aware of that you think are doing things particularly well in dealing with, remote learning or with this kind of phased in thing? I guess it's increasingly common now for school districts to have the kids get split into groups and then they go in one or two days a week as a group but are places doing it better than worse? And if so, what's the common denominator?
Yeah, I'm sure there are some places doing it better than worse. I mean, some school districts are reopening with in-person instruction for students, but this is few and far between. If you look at Education Week's latest data on this with their reopening tracker, out of the 100 largest school districts in the U.S., 3/4 of them are not reopening with any in-person instruction available to students, whereas only about 1/4 are reopening with some type of in-person instruction available to students. But as far as remote learning, I'm sure there's differences in quality levels. But even then, if there's a school district that's getting the remote learning right, that may not work for every single family. Let's say you're a school district that just knocked it out of the park and you did a really great job with getting the right number of hours with the remote learning and your teachers are doing a great job with the systems in place. It might not work for a family that needs the in-person instruction for their particular situation. So that's a great argument for school choice, in that a one-size-fits-all approach could work for a lot of people, but it might not fit and work for an individual family who particularly it could be, let's say you're a single parent household or you're a family that's relying on two incomes to get by and you're trying to return to work.
Hey, this is a libertarian podcast. So let's say you're a polyamorous couple and you have 6 adults, and 4 children. Also could be complicated, right?
Yep. Yeah. And it could even be where one of the children in the household, it works best for them to do the virtual school environment. Maybe that's fine, but maybe another one just thrives better in the in-person setting. It's really hard to tell. And because there are these differences in needs of individual students, that's a great argument for letting families sort into different educational. And I always like to say that despite what a lot of people say on the other side, school choice isn't anti-public school. It's just pro-choice and pro-family and pro-meeting the individual needs of individual students. You similarly wouldn't say that allowing people to shop at Whole Foods is anti-Trader Joe's for some reason. You would never say that. It's just pro-choice. Like you may even prefer Trader Joe's. It doesn't mean that you're anti anything. You could still prefer the public school and still be for school choice.
Do you think that it's also by bringing, I guess this is maybe stretching the analogy a little bit, but people talked about the Vietnam War as the living room war and that, people turned against the war partly because for the first time, even though they remembered Korea and World War II, they were seeing, a war and the effects of war in their living room every day. In an analogous way, what's going on with COVID lockdowns and kids being forced to learn at home, parents or guardians are seeing what their kids are doing. And again, I mean, the response of my acquaintances is they're kind of appalled at the quality of instruction, at the quantity of instruction, just at what's being transmitted. Do you think this is a kind of an awakening moment for parents?
Oh, yeah. People are really starting to see what's going on in the classroom. Like you said, it could be partially that they're seeing that the instruction isn't what they expected it to be. But then also it could be a lot of people complaining about political indoctrination in the classroom. And this could be for either side. It could be too far left, too far right, too pro-government, too not pro-government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen families on social media complaining about, for example, teachers, ranting anti-Trump sentiment, or, you know, for example, a Philadelphia educator in Philadelphia school district, before they started returning to the classroom virtually, did a whole long thread where he pointed out that he was concerned about doing the virtual learning because of what conservative parents were going to think about what he was teaching to the children.
Right.
And so a lot of conservative parents got upset about that. But it's not just a conservative issue. It could be that you're in a rural school district and maybe your teacher's teaching too much of a pro-Trump agenda in the classroom. And so the issue can go either way. And that's another good argument for choice. And it's not a partisan thing. It could be, you know, it's one biased in one way or another. And families shouldn't have to, you know, have their children experience that, and they shouldn't have to pay for it. They should be able to take their money elsewhere.
It is amazing, you know, because what's the, you know, kind of median or average per pupil spending? You know, and obviously it varies widely around the country, but what do we spend for a public school kid?
About $15,000 per child per
year.
So,
I mean, it is like if you single that out as a line item in a household budget for, you know, a house that has two kids or something, K through 12 education is easily going to be like the biggest single item in any given year, pretty much. And we know nothing. I mean, it's like the bad old days of buying cars where you would go to the lot and you were a complete stooge of whatever the dealer, your new car or used car dealer, wanted to tell you about the car. And like, you know, when you go to buy a car now, everybody knows that everybody knows everything or can find out everything. There's so much information out there. It continually staggers my mind how we just turn our kids over to schools, oftentimes private schools as well, without any real knowledge or, you know, kind of sophistication about what we're getting.
Yeah. And I want to say another thing that people are re-envisioning is how we finance education. Mm-hmm. They're saying, you know, families have always been getting the short end of the stick when it comes to K through 12 education, but it's more obvious now than ever because so many of the schools aren't even opening and they're still getting your children's education dollars, even if you are being pushed to do the homeschooling thing,
right.
If you need to seek out a pandemic pod or a micro school, or even if you're being forced to do like a private daycare or private school option, the public school is still getting the system's still getting your child's education dollars, even though they're not reopening. Whereas, you know, if you're a family on food stamps and your neighborhood grocery store doesn't reopen, they don't get to keep your food stamps.
Yeah.
Or even if you're paying out of pocket, they don't get to keep any of your money. You could take your money to Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. So I think families are similarly looking at this setup and seeing that they're getting the short end of the stick and they're not being listened to, and that the money's staying in the system regardless of their satisfaction and their choice, and regardless of whether the building's even open. And so families are turning towards the idea that the funding should follow the student to wherever they're getting an education.
So at the same time that seems to be happening, and certainly everybody, I think, once it's explained to them or they think about it for a second, that logic becomes clear that, you know, it's my kid who is sitting here next to me while I'm trying to do work, they're trying to do work, and the money should be following the kid because we're not even going into that giant gymnasium with a couple of classrooms attached to it, you know, down the road or across the city or something. But then teachers' unions in particular have been outspoken in their response to kind of the lockdowns. Like, how would you characterize the, you know, the nature and the tenor of the way that teachers' unions have responded to COVID lockdowns and being asked or having it demanded of them that they go back into the classroom?
Well, they've been kicking and screaming the whole way. You've seen a lot of protests pouring into the streets in major cities. You saw 10 teachers' unions from major cities link up with the Democratic Socialists of America and to call for a massive federal infusion of dollars to reopen the schools in a safe way. They called it their Demand Safe Schools Initiative, mm-hmm. but then they also called for a lot of political things all across the country, from defunding the police or police-free schools to banning standardized testing and banning their competition through banning new charter schools and banning private school choice programs. And we saw a lot of this throughout the whole debate. And a lot of people are arguing that the teachers unions actually overplayed their hands here, because now a lot of families are actually just leaving the system, right. That the schools aren't opening for them. They're not, that the public school system is not there for so many families this year. And we're seeing enrollment drops in so many places. The latest national polling I saw from this was from Gallup. A nationally representative survey, they estimate about a 7 percentage point drop in the proportion of students in traditional public schools this year. That would be about 3.5 million students leaving the public school system. And if you look at homeschool filings, they're through the roof everywhere.
Do you think, I have a number of friends who are administrators at colleges, and one of the things that colleges were really worried about, particularly, you know, if you're not, a high name, like, you know, a great brand as a college, you know, they were freaking out that a lot of kids were taking gap years or deferring admission because, you know, it's going to be virtual. It's not really worth their time or anything, because they say if you lose the kid, you know, in like the freshman year, or between the freshman and sophomore year, they never come back. Do you think that this 7% drop, is it going to be 14% next year, or will most of those kids go back to a traditional public school?
I mean, it's really hard to tell, right? A lot of this was guesswork. From the beginning of this, I think I did a poll on Twitter asking people, you know, how much do you think homeschooling is going to go up in 2020? And most people said that, oh, it's probably going to stay 3 or 4% in the mm-hmm. U.S. But now we have the Gallup poll suggesting that it's going to double from 3 to about 6% in the U.S. if the doubling actually occurs. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to tell, but there is one poll that was a national poll by Civis Analytics, mm-hmm. and they found that among people who disenrolled their children from the school that they were supposed to go to this year, mm-hmm. 17% of them said that even if the school reopens and even if they think that it's safe to return, they don't plan on returning to the school mm-hmm. that they disenrolled from. So we have some evidence that, you know, maybe about a fifth of that shift remains mm-hmm. long-term.
What about, are private schools seeing a bump in education or in enrollments? Because, you know, I guess it varies from private school to private school. Some of them are doing more of a job to keep the students, either to open up in traditional forms or conventional formats, or to stay attached to the students, because they will lose the money if they don't reopen. But is there an increase in enrollment in private schools and traditional private schools? And if so, by how much?
Yeah, it depends on the private schools too. And we don't have comprehensive data on this, but we've seen reports of increases in some places, decrease in other places. Just today, I saw a news story on charter schools in El Paso. They are reopening in person, whereas the traditional public schools aren't. But so the traditional schools are seeing, or the charter schools are seeing upticks in enrollment.
Right.
Similarly, I saw a news story from South Carolina. The charter school authorizers there expect about a 40% increase in enrollment this year in their charter school sector. So we don't have a lot of evidence from the private school sector, but we have more hard data from charter schools suggesting that families are switching from traditional to charters. And I think it's because they're more likely to open their doors and to meet the needs of families.
So, talking about charters, which is it right to say that charters are the most popular form of school choice currently? Is that accurate?
As far as amount of people using charter schools versus private school choice programs, a lot more people have their children enrolled in charter schools, about 6%.
Could you very briefly define charter schools for the yep. purposes of this podcast?
Yeah, so charter schools on the books are public schools of choice, meaning you're not residentially assigned to them. I would argue that they're more of like a quasi-private public school, because mm-hmm. they're privately managed, but they are tuition-free, which makes them kind of like a public mm-hmm. school. They cannot be religious, which makes them kind of like a public school. And they're highly regulated by the government, which makes them more like public right. schools. So they're kind of a public-private entity
And
easiest way to think of it as a public school of choice. You're not residentially assigned to
right. them. And generally speaking, they have much more latitude than a conventional or traditional K through 12 school in terms of curriculum, in terms of staffing and things like that.
Yep. Although they're highly regulated, they are still mm-hmm. less tend to be less regulated. They have more autonomy than the traditional public schools. But they also do not have freedom with their admissions standards. They generally have to accept all students at random, as opposed to traditional public schools. They can discriminate on the basis of zip code through residential assignment, and district-run magnet schools can have selective admissions, but charter right. schools cannot do that in general.
Yes. So charters remain highly controversial. And I know, for instance, in the LA Unified School District, which is the nation's second largest school district, a big point of contention when the teachers unions there were calling for reforms is that they wanted to limit the number of charter schools in the district, even as they were saying that there is no way you're going to put us back in school, in front of your kids who will kill us with COVID. But charters are controversial. Recently, Samantha Bee, the comedian who has a show on TBS, did a segment kind of attacking charter schools, slagging them as unregulated, as incompetent, as no either less likely or no more likely than a traditional public school to do well for their students. What is the truth about charter schools in terms of performance?
The charter schools aren't accountable to families. Why are 3.2 million families choosing charter schools each and every year? It's probably because they are accountable to families. Families can take their children elsewhere if the charter schools aren't doing a good job. So I would argue charter schools are much more accountable than traditional public schools in general. And if you look at the evidence on this, the latest meta-analysis that I've seen on the evidence for charter schools is by Julian Betts and Emily Tang, a 2019 publication, a chapter in a book called School Choice at the Crossroads. And they found that overall, looking at the most rigorous evidence, looking at random assignment, gold standard evaluations, and other evaluations that try to make it as apples to apples as possible when looking at these comparisons, they conclude that there's about a 2-3% standard deviation increase in academic outcomes if you get access to a charter school, which is about, about 12 to 16 days of additional learning if you look at Credo's estimates on that.
Yeah. Are charters, are they unrepresentative, though? Because this is also one of the arguments is that charters skim students or they do not represent the typical demographic range, both in terms of, kind of race and ethnicity, mm-hmm. but also things like learning disabilities. Do they educate an atypical group of students?
Depends on the specific location, but if you look at the United States overall, charter schools serve higher proportions of minority students and higher proportions of low-income students as defined by the federal free or reduced lunch program. So they do serve higher proportions of disadvantaged families by those measures, but from what I can tell, they tend to serve lower proportions of students with special needs. Mm-hmm. But also, there was a random assignment study that just came out looked at Boston, Massachusetts charter schools, and they found that winning a lottery to attend a charter school reduced the likelihood that students with special needs would actually be labeled as special needs students. So when you're looking right. at these average comparisons, since they lose that classification, it's not a fair comparison to say that charter schools actually serve less students with special needs, since they lose that classification at higher rates.
And that study of Boston schools was written up in Education Next by Elizabeth Cetrin, and it is pretty, it's very convincing and very compelling and very upbeat that charters, where you're looking at people who applied to charters and the ones who got in versus the ones who went to traditional schools and the ones who went to charter schools across the board, particularly for low-income people or at-risk students, seem to do much better overall in charters.
Yep. In that study that you're talking about in Education Next, I think they found pretty large increases in 10th grade academic proficiencies on their state exam, and then also higher enrollments in college as well. There were some other findings as well. I can't remember off the top of my head, but the findings were overall positive for students with special needs that won a lottery to attend a charter, and then also students that were identified as English language learner students. And I also want to say for the listeners, this is the gold standard of social science research, because it's kind of like a medical trial, where the way that we know medicine works is that one group randomly receives a treatment or medicine, whereas random lottery determines whether another group gets a placebo or a sugar pill. And right. If you compare the average outcomes between the two groups, you can say it's the effect of the medicine. Similarly, with charter schools, because it's random lottery determining who gets access or not, we can say it's the effect of the charter school and not the family background or the student background.
Why do you think charter schools remain so controversial? I have to say, Samantha Bee, who was a correspondent on The Daily Show, John Oliver, who also has his own show on HBO a couple of years ago, did a similar segment on charter schools, yeah. also from The Daily Show originally. And, what is it about elite, highly educated people who have school choice, and they might send their kids to a traditional public school or to a private school or to, a magnet school. Samantha Bee's kids go to a school in New York City. It's a public school that does not publicize what its admission policy is, but a lot of celebrities' kids manage to go to this public school. What is it that drives the it's one thing to say like, okay, I'm not going to send my kid to a charter school because it might suck. Mm-hmm. But like then to denounce the system and kind of use your political position or your public position to kind of ruin that for other people. What drives that kind of sensibility?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that Samantha Bee sent her child to the Center School in Pennsylvania, which is a magnet school, uses selective admissions. So it's actually less public than a charter school, because charter schools in general have to use random admissions, whereas magnet schools, I'm not sure if this was particularly a magnet school, but it does have selective admissions like other magnet right. schools, in that they don't have to accept students at random. So they're less public than charter schools. But I think a lot of the sentiment against charter schools and other school choice initiatives, such as private school voucher programs, is this thing that we talked about at the beginning with Virginia Walden Ford's chapter in the School Choice Myths book, that there's a lot of people that just think that low-income families, for whatever reason, aren't capable of making educational decisions when it comes to their children's educational environment. They think that it's okay for them to be able to make these choices, but mm-hmm. when it comes to other families, they may not trust them to be able to make these decisions, which I think is a totally paternalistic way of viewing things. And I think it's the heart of a lot of anti-school choice sentiment. And it's a huge problem. We see so many politicians all throughout the United States that exercise school choice for their own kids, whether it comes to private mm-hmm. schools or these magnet schools, but then oppose private school choice programs that benefit disproportionately low-income families and allows them to be able to choose their schools. You look at Joe Biden, for example, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Roy Cooper from North Carolina. There's a whole bunch of these politicians who it's kind of like this choice for me, but not for thee mentality.
Let's talk about Joe Biden as well as Donald Trump. One of them is going to be president, right? Is going to be elected president in November. Joe Biden has been very outspoken in specifically talking, and in a interview by the National Education Association, the country's largest teachers union, he said that he was going to limit or end publicly funded charter schools or restrict them much more so. What is Joe Biden's kind of policy agenda towards school choice, broadly speaking? What's that look like?
What's interesting, if you go to his campaign website and you search for the word charter school, it doesn't show up at all. So he doesn't have an official position. And I think there's a reason for this, is because he's trying to appeal to communities that benefit from charter schools, but then he also wants the support from the teachers union. So if he comes out publicly one way or the other, it harms him as far as this presidential race. If he comes out for charter schools, the teachers union is going to be mad about that. If he comes out against charter schools, disadvantaged communities who would otherwise vote for him may be upset about
that.
Yeah,
they might be like, screw it.
Yeah, so maybe I won't vote for, maybe they'll vote for a third party or will abstain from voting altogether if they hear something like that. So that's one of the things. But if you look at the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force mm-hmm. and what they talked about with school choice was that they called to end the DC voucher program. This is a program that disproportionately benefits benefits disadvantaged families. Average household income of people in the DC voucher program is only around $27,000, which is pretty low for a high cost of living area like DC.
Yep.
And 95% of the students using the program are Black or Hispanic students. And then also, yeah, in that same Biden Sanders Unity Task Force, they called to increase regulations on charter schools. And he's been pretty openly against for-profit charter schools. But yeah, if you look at like those interviews.
But by the way, for-profit charter schools are negligible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's only about 12% of the total. And I would say it's okay. Who cares if it's for-profit or not? If the if the profit's not a bad, you know, we have a whole bunch of for-profit businesses and other industries, and it's okay. And to me, it's okay as long as it's voluntary. The public school system all too often profits in a way through coercion.
Of course.
Through coercion.
No, and everybody, and I think there are legitimate gripes about certain kinds of for-profit educational institutions and higher ed, you know, where they qualify for guaranteed student loans and then they don't really deliver for their students in terms of graduating them or, you know, getting them jobs, whatever. Mm-hmm. People can determine that. But like the idea that a public school is not a source of profit for everybody who is getting paid by it, it's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, that's the real problem.
And as long as you can walk away, who cares if the person who's giving you a great education or a crap education is lining their pockets? But
yeah, exactly. And if a charter school is a for-profit charter school and they're wasting their money and not spending it wisely, if they're keeping their expenses too low and not delivering a good product to maximize their profit, well, go somewhere else. And that's why school choice is so important, because yeah, you have so many people profiting from the system of residential assignment and compulsory funding through property taxes in systems that don't have school choice. They're profiting from monopoly power, and that's when it's a problem.
Do you worry? I am old enough and was raised Catholic enough to actually recall moments in the late 60s and early 70s. This was growing up in New Jersey, where there were very sharp lines and kind of fights about whether or not any state money could go to Catholic schools, including just leasing books or lending books to Catholic schools. And for a while, my old brother, who's older than me, my parents actually had to buy his books in order, you know, when he attended Catholic school, because the state no longer would give them. You know, a lot of that has been addressed, but there remains a serious, you know, question about the intersection of freedom of religion and freedom from religion and public education, publicly funded education. How does that factor into debates and arguments over public choice programs in K through 12?
Yeah, we'll say charter schools are not allowed to have any religious affiliation. So that takes that argument off the table when it comes
to
charter schools.
Well, they can't do religious instruction, right? Yeah. I mean, but charters are often run by religious organizations, right?
Yeah, so they can't have the religious instruction. But then when it comes to private school choice programs, that we actually have a chapter on this by Institute for Justice attorney Tim Keller, is this myth that school choice is unconstitutional. But all of these people saying this would not say this about Pell Grants. Pell Grants go to the money goes to the family, and you can choose a religious university or a non-religious university. Right. Same thing with pre-K programs. The money goes to parents, and you can choose a religiously affiliated pre-K or not.
And it's ironic that like K through 12 is mandatory. I mean, you have to go there. You have to send your kids there. Otherwise, you'll go to jail. But you can't have choice then. It's kind of peculiar, right? That you can use tax dollars to go to whatever college you want, but not whatever high school.
Yep. And there's Supreme Court precedent on this. You look at Zelman versus Simmons-Harris in 2002. This was regarding a publicly funded voucher program in Ohio. And they were arguing that it violated the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution. But there isn't a separation of church and state issue because, like with Pell Grants, the money goes to people, and people can choose public or private, religious private or non-religious private. Because the main beneficiary of that funding is the family and the student and not the school, there isn't a separation of church and state or any violation of the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Same thing with the Social Security dollars. Social Security dollars go to people. You could spend it on a private religious K through 12 school. And that's not a separation of church and state issue, because the primary beneficiary is the person, not the institution.
So let's talk about Donald Trump. You know, and I remember this a while ago, I interviewed Virginia Walden Ford, who created the DC opportunity scholarship program, or was central in its founding, which Barack Obama also scuttled for a while, and then it got reinstituted. But it, you know, I asked her, you know, Donald Trump has been the best president in terms of school choice, you know, certainly since the modern school choice movement started, you know, after World War II. And I asked her, like, you know, is that, does that make it a harder sell among, particularly among low-income people who are heavily ethnic, you know, Latino and Black in particular, who are most likely to benefit and really need publicly funded school choice because they don't have the means otherwise? But does it hurt, like, does it hurt the cause to have somebody like Donald Trump, who is such a divisive figure and, you know, gets in the single digits of, you know, votes from those groups? Does it hurt?
I don't think so.
Is it a bad thing to have Donald Trump be the most school choice president, you know, that has been?
No, I don't think so. And I think it's because if nobody cares about school choice, you're stuck with the status quo, which is no school choice. And so I'd rather have someone championing it and getting people very fired up about school choice, even if it's just half of the population. It's better that to get half of the population fired up and maybe some on the other side than to have no one care about school choice at all. And to just sit with what we have all along, which is just your residentially assigned monopoly school. And so, yeah, I mean, him kind of talking about it gets people talking about school choice. And I think since the facts are on the side of school choice and logic is on the side of school choice, once people start talking about it, then they'll start to support it more. And if you look at the latest polling from Real Clear Education on this, since April, support for school choice initiatives has actually gone up by 10 percentage points. And so we don't know if it's because of Trump talking about it. It probably has more to do with the school not opening.
But it's either because or in spite of, right? So
yeah,
I mean, the fact is he's talking about it and support is still going up.
Still going up. And yeah, if you look over the last few years, support for school choice has been pretty steady as well, particularly for private school choice programs, whether that's a universal program or a targeted program. People generally support these initiatives, whether you look at the Education Next polling on this or the Real Clear Education polling on this.
Let me ask this is to go deeper into kind of libertarian weeds. The Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education, was created in the very late 70s by Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan, when he was running for president in 1980, campaigned on saying he was going to get rid of it because this was, you know, just a disgraceful expansion of federal power. The fact of the matter is that federal spending on education had been going up for decades before that. And even before there was a Department of Education, there was still an increasing amount of federal dollars going to fund education at the state and local level. You know, what is the proper, like, should who is president matter in terms of education policy? I mean, from a kind of libertarian, decentralist, small government perspective, would it be better if the federal government was just out of the education game? Or is, you know, I mean, how do you deal with that kind of
issue? The Department of Education should have never been born. It's not in the U.S. Constitution. It should be up to the states. So that's my first take on it, that it shouldn't matter who's in charge, whether that's.
But can I also ask, though, I mean, just to complicate that, and I'm sorry to I guess I'm front loading a bunch of stuff here. But then, you know, you think back, and again, Virginia Walden Ford, who is just a phenomenal person and figure and activist and everything, but she was among the second wave of kids in Little Rock, Arkansas, who integrated public schools that were segregated by law. They were taxpayer funded. And, you know, the Little Rock, Arkansas, and many school districts around the country either explicitly de jure or de facto, you know, were segregated. And it took, you know, it took the force of the federal government to integrate those schools. So is it, you know, when you say, I guess what I was recalling or reacting to is that you say, you know, the federal government, it shouldn't be involved in education. It should be a state issue. But then it's, you know, what about states where they were actively creating separate and unequal educational opportunities?
We still have segregated public schools in the United States, and we have a Department of Education. So I think a lot of these problems are solved on the ground through social movements. And I think it's not the government that creates this. I think the government action tends to come after the social movement on the ground. So that's my first response. But then also, you know, this could be solved in the courts without having a federal Department of Education. So we don't need a Department of Education for, you know,
certainly
to fix that issue.
Do you, what about at the state level then? Because, you know, in my most libertarian moments, I will devolve and decentralize power so much that my left hand doesn't have control over my right hand. But, you know, so if the federal government shouldn't be involved in K through 12 education, you know, it should be devolved to the states, but then maybe the state government shouldn't be. It should be, you know, because people used to talk about education as the, you know, archetypal local issue. But it's also true that, you know, a lot of the times when you were devolving power to localities, you were also, you know, devolving it to people who were absolutely writing out a whole part of the population from enjoying in the benefits of a tax-funded, you know, enterprise.
Well, at least at the state level, education is prescribed in state-level constitutions, but it's not in the federal constitution. So I think that's the main difference there. But yeah, you could, you know, take that logic down to the local level and you know, have government out of education altogether. You know, in like a libertarian utopia, you wouldn't have government involved at all or very little. Kind of like the way I think about it is, you know, we have food stamps, for example, and food stamps go to the least advantaged families, but you don't have the government running grocery stores for those families. Families are able to take their dollars to wherever they want to shop. And we don't have food stamps for 100% of the population. We just have it for the least advantaged. So you can kind of think of an alternative universe where education is structured in the same way, where we fund education for the least advantaged because we, you know, maybe we have some social goals for more equity, but we certainly want it. If we kind of think about it from a libertarian's perspective today, we wouldn't fund it for everybody. We wouldn't have food stamps for everybody. And we wouldn't have government running all of the grocery stores. Similarly, in education, we could have a similar situation where we fund it for the least advantage and don't necessarily need the government to run the institutions.
And that would, I must say that I like the sound of that because we are, you know, for all of the talk now about things like universal basic income and Medicare for all, et cetera, we have passed the point where the government can afford to give, to fully fund everybody at every level. And I know for myself, like I'm doing pretty well, I can pay for my kids' education. I can save for it and pay for it. And I should do that. And I should do that for my healthcare and for my retirement. And I think government works better when it focuses on smaller populations with distinct needs and, you know, and doesn't distort whole markets. Because, you know, it's funny when you talk about the idea of food stamps, which of course is really a subsidy to the agricultural, you know, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the people that, you know, that benefit from its programs. But the fact that somebody with food stamps can, they buy the same Coca-Cola or the same butter that you and I do, they don't get a shitty version of that. Whereas like when with Medicaid, it's a little bit different, you know, et cetera. So it's interesting. Tell me a little bit about your, you went through the legendary, your PhD is from the legendary University of Arkansas education program. And by legendary, I also mean notorious among, you know, pro teachers unions, people hate Arkansas, pro school choice, people love it. How did you end up getting involved? Where did you grow up? What kind of school experience did you have? And how did you end up becoming an education analyst?
Yeah, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and went through the public education system all through K through 12. So if I made any mistakes on this conversation today, that's probably has something to do with it. But actually, I did get a little bit of exposure to school choice in San Antonio in my high school years, in that I was able to attend a district-run magnet school with selective admission. So I wasn't residentially assigned to that school, and I felt like it had a positive—
How did you get in? Did you get in by having the most mismatched first name and last name, a very middle American name and a very ethnic last name? Or what was your— How did you get in?
Yeah, I remember there was a really short application. I think you had like certain attendance levels and your grades that were submitted in middle school.
That is a dark statement about a magnet school. If like you can get into this magnet school if you show up 75% of the time.
Yeah, I don't think the admissions were like super crazy, like Samantha Bee's child's
right. Or and it wasn't like Stuyvesant High School in New York, or you know these legendary schools where you know everybody gets in by getting 1,000% on a 100-point score, you know, a test, exam, and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, I felt like I benefited from that. Just you know, I saw the school that I was residentially assigned to, and I felt like they weren't. You know, the classrooms were more disorderly. There were more fights in the hallways because the magnet school was actually on the campus of the residentially assigned school. And I ended up playing sports for the residentially assigned school, which was a really cool setup for students at least. But yeah, in San Antonio, we were able to pick in my district, like four different magnet schools with different kind of specialties. So I thought that was great. And that really got me started to be interested in school choice. But then also I did my bachelor's and master's in economics at the University of Texas at San Antonio under Dr. John Merrifield, who is a Friedman Fellow at the EdChoice, a think tank in support of school choice. And that really opened my mind to the biggest problems in the K-12 education system, in that we have residential assignment, which creates a geographic monopoly for traditional public schools, and compulsory funding through the property tax system, which is great for the producers, but not so great for the consumers of the services, the students and their families. So I started thinking more and more through that economics lens.
And you know, before we get to your PhD, which I'd like to talk about briefly, how do you break that connection of like, you know, of a geographical monopoly? Because, you know, one thing it does is it benefits the status quo, but it's also homeowners are traditionally sold, you know, by every realtor will tell you this, going in, you know, that somewhere between about 25% and maybe 40% of the value of your house is linked to the school districts. And you need to have good school districts. Otherwise, your housing value is going to go down, or you won't be able to sell it or whatever. How, you know, given that, and, you know, that is almost certainly oversold and whatnot. Yeah. But given that, how do you bring about, you know, really significant school choice reform when you have, you know, the teachers unions and the people who run the school are invested in it. You have homeowners who may or may not have kids, but they're more than willing to pay a premium for higher state, you know, higher income taxes or higher property taxes to keep certain types of people out so that the schools stay better, et cetera. Like, how do you break that connection in order to eventuate more school choice?
Yeah, when it comes to the teachers unions, I think it's just to point out these analogies where they support funding following students instead of institutions when it comes to all these other programs. Mm-hmm. And then just recalibrate the conversation to focus more on the needs of students than the needs of institutions. I think that's how we fight there. Sure. When it comes to the unions. And to also create a new special interest group, which I think is which is parents. And I think we're seeing some of that right now when it comes to the K-12 education debate, when it comes to schools not reopening. Families are becoming more and more of a concentrated interest. I mean, they're kind of a big interest group. They're not so much concentrated, but they're becoming more and more vocal about you know, the schools reopening in general, or just being able to take their education funding to wherever their kid gets an education, which we've seen in that Real Clear education polling with support for school choice jumping and families just voting with their feet to other alternatives, whether that be a pandemic pod or a homeschool option or a private school or a charter school. But then when it comes to the home values, I would argue, you know, these people still have access to those good schools. They can still send their children to those schools. And when we're talking about private school choice initiatives, this doesn't affect whether people can come to your public school at all. But when it comes to, you know, open enrollment policies, even when you have open enrollment policies in places like Arizona, where they have statewide open enrollment, where you don't have residential assignment, the families that live closest to the schools, they have a higher chance of getting their children in those schools. So they still have kind of that benefit for living there. And even if they didn't have a higher chance of getting their kids into the schools that they live closer to, I would think, you know, that as far as the families that choose to go to that particular school, it may not be a lot if they live far away from that school. So, you know, distance to school is another large part of the calculation with the type of school you want. But one last thing is, just because you buy into a system that's problematic doesn't mean that that system should stay that way. Just imagine if we bought our houses based on the one restaurant that we're able to attend if we lived in that house. yeah, that could, you know, hey, that's factored into your house price now, but that doesn't mean that the government should run restaurants, and that doesn't mean that people should be residentially assigned to restaurants. That's absolutely ridiculous. So just because there's a special interest invested in that system doesn't mean we should keep the system the way that it is. So similarly with schools, just because there's people that profit from buying into that system already doesn't mean that we should keep it that way.
Here is a kind of knuckleball to be thrown particularly late in this discussion. But again, going back to the misty memories of my early youth and whatnot, there was much more of a standard argument that you just, and you know, this was the tail end of the baby boom was starting to move into K through 12 school in the late 60s and early 70s. But where people would say, like, why should non-parents, either people who have already paid for schools and sent their kids through schools, or people who choose not to have kids, why should they be funding public schools at all through taxes? That argument seems to have gone completely missing.
Some people still bring it up, you know, when they say, hey, I don't have kids, why do I have to pay for the public school system? The standard response from economists is that there are positive externalities of education, that if you have a well-educated populace, you benefit from the transaction. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't consume the education.
Do you yourself. Buy that though? Talking about that, hey, if you gave me 15 grand a year just for being alive, I would be happier and you would be better.
Yeah, buy me a sports car, Nick, because I'm happy when I have a sports car. Right. And that would benefit you because it would be easier to talk to me. I don't buy that argument. Even if we did buy the argument that there are positive externalities to education, there are still private benefits to education. So you could still make the argument that perhaps people without kids still contribute towards the education system through taxes, but maybe they pay less than people with kids because they receive less of that benefit. So you can still acknowledge externalities that way. And I don't think it's legitimate argument to force me to pay for. You can continue that logic. Hey, there's this professional development course here that I got that was offered to me, Nick. And I was told if I did it, I would become a CEO. And if I become a CEO, that's more tax revenues. That would benefit you. So you should pay for it. No, I should probably pay for that, or my employer should pay for it.
It's an interesting question, partly because when you think of somebody like Milton Friedman, who's often considered the father of the modern school choice movement because of his 1955 essay where he talks about, the voucher program, as it still is kind of being discussed now. He basically takes for granted that the state is going to be involved in education. And, I'm not a libertarian purist, so I'm happy to, to start with that as a presumption. But it strikes me as kind of odd that especially now that people choose much more kind of explicitly, it seems, to either have kids or not have kids than they might have in the past, that argument about, why am I being forced to pay for somebody else's choices, just doesn't really seem to resonate at all.
No, it doesn't. And, when it comes to the externality argument, it typically is an argument that you will underconsume the amount of services that would get you to the socially optimal level of consumption for that services. So that's an argument when it comes to food, for food stamps for the least advantaged. But with education, we take that argument and then we fund essentially food stamps, education stamps for everyone. Whereas the externality argument should only get you to funding that percentage of the population who may not otherwise be able to afford it to get you to that socially optimum level of consumption.
Yeah, and I think that given the constraints that are everywhere around us, except in the amounts of money that government actually chooses to spend, we need to start looking at those things where we are targeting interventions into markets or for citizens who otherwise cannot afford or don't have access to opportunities and markets and things like that. Very quickly, tell me about your dissertation. What was your dissertation on at University of Arkansas, and how did that turn out for you?
Yeah, it's called The Societal Impacts of Private School Choice Around the World. It was three essays. The main essay was my evaluation of the Milwaukee Voucher Program and its effects on criminal activity when the students became around 25 years of age. I did this with Patrick Wolf, a professor at the University of Arkansas, and we used state student-level data from the state-mandated evaluation of the program. And we looked up individual criminal activity records for the students once they became adults in the Wisconsin government system. All you really needed was first name, last name, and date of birth to look those things up in Wisconsin. And we were able to do that. And after controlling for a bunch of different characteristics of the students, from race to income bracket to whether they lived in a two-parent household, we found that kids that were exposed to the program in eighth or ninth grade, they were significantly less likely to commit certain types of crime. And we that dissertation chapter is now a peer-reviewed study at Social Science Quarterly. And we did an update on that study that's now published in the Journal of Private Enterprise, where we followed the students until they were a little bit older, maybe around 28, 29 years of age, and found the same result.
I thought you were going to say that what you found was that when they did criminal activity, it was more white collar crime, that they were committing crime at a higher level of sophistication or cultivation.
Well, we, you know, one of the main findings that we found in the follow up study was the biggest reduction had to do with the drug related crimes. And then we also found a reduction in paternity disputes in our second study.
Hmm. Oh, that's fascinating.
So the theory there is it could be, you know, character skills or maybe just the culture of the school that's different in the private school. And so maybe there's less risky activities going on in the private setting.
It is, you know, it remains fascinating that I think everybody in America, I think it's part of our character. And certainly in the past 100 years, with the, you know, when America became kind of characterized itself or defined itself as an immigrant nation, you know, how important education was to the future of the country. You wanted your kids to do better, to go to good schools so that they had more opportunities. And it just, it's odd that we're stuck now at a moment where people are debating, you know, kind of energizing school choice, because, you know, we all know in every other aspect of our lives that being able to sort among competing alternatives, you know, that cost the same or less, you know, you just have better outcomes. It's a shame that we haven't quite got there. But as a final thought, do you think that, you know, that the COVID lockdown then actually may end up kind of speeding up, you know, the school choice movement to, if not quite to the promised land, at least, you know, yep, roughly adjacent?
Yes, yeah, it's been said to be one of the silver linings of the pandemic, that the school system has gotten so bad that families are figuring out that there's no good reason to fund institutions when you can fund students directly instead. Like I said earlier, mm-hmm, if your grocery store doesn't reopen, you can take your money elsewhere. If your child's school doesn't reopen, you should similarly be able to take your children's education dollars elsewhere. And as a matter of fact, even if your school did reopen, you should still be able to take your child's education dollars elsewhere, because the money is supposed to be meant for the education of the child. It's not supposed to be meant for propping up and protecting a government monopoly. And so we saw this huge spike in school choice support since April, a 10 percentage point jump in the proportion of families that now support school choice initiatives from 67 to 77%. And then we're also just seeing a lot of reports of families being concerned about the public schools aren't even opening, yet they're still getting their children's education dollars. And that just doesn't make any sense when you look at all of these other taxpayer-funded initiatives, that the funding follows the person. It doesn't go to the institution, regardless of how well it meets your needs. And so I think more people are seeing this issue with how we finance K-12 education.
Well, thank you. We're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Corey DeAngelis. He's the director of school choice at Reason Foundation, the sister organization of Reason Magazine. We're both published by Reason Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. And Corey is the co-editor of the excellent new collection, School Choice Myths. Corey DeAngelis, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there.